In Genesis 33, we see Jacob patching things up with his brother Esau. And what a great thing when reconciliation happens and restoration happens with relationships that there has been hostilities or there's been animosity or when a relationship strained or has fallen apart. Now, I know none of you here have ever had that experience, so this is all going to be theoretical. But, you know, one day this was years ago when we were over at the Broadway storefront. I had kind of a little habit that I'd fallen into, and that was I was studying on Wednesdays for Wednesday night service, and I would go down to the Fiesta Ole and have a lunch and then, you know, continue studying through the afternoon. And one particular Wednesday, I had no idea what kind of show was going to be going on there for me. I walked in, and there was a mother and a daughter, and the mother was taking the car keys away from her daughter. And as I walked by, she's like, "You may not have the car anymore." And she pulled the car keys, and I don't know what the issue was. And I was going up to order, and I ordered, and I was coming back. And here was a mother and her son on the other side of the room. And as I walked by them, the boy was pleading with his mother, "Please, please don't tell Dad. Whatever you do, don't tell Dad." And I walked by, and I thought, what's the odds? Well, I had no idea that the climax of the lunch hour had not yet taken place. As I sat down and I got my meal and I was eating it, a gal who was an employee there who had waited on me in time past was obviously off duty, walked into Fiesta Ole, walked behind the counter and another employee there. She began to slap her in the face. And I guess as they began to scream and yell, and I was somewhat awestruck with my burrito in my hand about this little fanfare that was going on. And the manager came out, and the manager told her to get out. And as they were shouting at each other, the one girl had stolen the other girl's boyfriend. And, that is drama, drama, drama. But I'd been praying for some illustrations, so it just really worked well for me. But there was, you know, conflicts and struggles. But it's a beautiful thing when God puts back together that which has fallen apart. And that's the story of Genesis 33. And so we're going to look at Jacob's restoration and his relationship with Esau, his brother, his twin brother. Also, his restitution that he desires to give to him. And lastly, the separation of these two brothers. For it says in verse 1, "Now Jacob lifted his eyes and looked, and there Esau was coming. And with him were 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two maidservants. And he put the maidservants and their children in front, Leah and her children behind, and Rachel and Joseph's last. Then he crossed over before them and bowed himself to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. But Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. And he lifted his eyes and saw the women and children and said, 'Who are these with you?' And so he said, 'The children whom God has graciously given your servant.' Then the maidservants came near, they and their children, and bowed down. And Leah also came near with her children, and they bowed down. Afterward, Joseph and Rachel came near, and they bowed down." Those who have been traveling with us through this portion of Scripture realize that Jacob has had a sleepless night. He has wrestled with an angel of the Lord who put his hip out of socket so that he now is going to walk with a limp the rest of his life. But he had a fresh glimpse of the Lord, so much so that he names the place Peniel, which means the face of God. Seeing the Lord's face, not physically. We know, as the Lord told Moses years later, that you can't look on God's face as a human being and live. But it was the same to Jacob in this experience with this angel, that God had so intimately revealed himself to Jacob that he felt like, man, there was this fresh connection and understanding of who God is. And I think that's key to prepare us for reconciliation. Because I've discovered in my own life, unless I am broken, unless I am intimate with the Lord, I actually have very little desire to be reconciled with people. Because the two go together. It's when I'm right vertically in my relationship with God, I also have a desire to be right horizontally with my fellow man. But if I am not right with God, why should I be right with you? And it's one of those experiences that you will discover in life that the two go hand in hand. As we're right with the Lord, as we're broken in our relationship with God, and God humbles us, and we realize who we are and our own frailties and our own weaknesses and our own inabilities to really often be who we're supposed to be. Realizing our failure on our side of the desk. Realizing that we have fallen short many, many times. Therefore, if God gives us a fresh glimpse of His grace and mercy, I want to be gracious and merciful to other people who have maybe let me down, or at least a desire for me to pursue patching things up if I've let them down. And so here, Jacob, it's a sleepless night. He's limping, but he's just been humbled and broken before the Lord. And he sees this cloud of dust, and here comes Esau with 400 men. They appear to be mounted, if you will. You can infer that in the story, whether they're riding camels or they're riding horses or whatever the case may be. And this cloud of dust, as it's coming towards Jacob, Jacob does some last-minute organizing. You know, he's prayed for God's help, but Jacob's an organizer. But as he organizes, he displays one of the real flaws in his life that's going to come back to haunt him in the family, and that is favoritism. Now, this is how he organizes. He puts Bilhah and Zilpah and their children up in front. How would you like to be the ones up in front with 400 men coming at you? That's what Jacob, you never have to wonder in Jacob's family who's the favorites and who are not the favorites. Because his actions tell you very loud and clear who's close to his heart and who's far from his heart. Bilhah and Zilpah and their children are up front, then Leah and her children, and then, oh yes, Rachel and Joseph are last because they're the favorites. Now, this would be very disheartening if Jacob then stayed behind and let the girls meet the 400 men. And yet Jacob, if you're going to experience real reconciliation with people, I think there's some key principles in this story that are helpful to us in our own hearts. And that is, first of all, Jacob in our last chapter had a fresh glimpse of the Lord. And he was broken before the Lord in this wrestling match with an angel. And that's key to reconciliation. But now we see that Jacob is going to be very courageous. He gets out in front. He gets out in front of Bilhah and Zilpah and Leah and Rachel. And as he's out in front leading, it had to bring comfort to those ladies' hearts that he was, okay, he is going to be protecting us. Because there's a desire, I think, for your wife and your children to respect you. And it's hard to respect you when you're the guy that's in back and pushing them up in front to take care of all the conflicts in life. But when you will take the lead, I read somewhere that in the Israeli army, they had removed the phrase in their military, forward march. And they replaced it with their leadership, follow me. Now, those are two different things. A commander from the rear says, forward, march, march into battle, you guys. But they removed that and said, follow me, that the leaders had to be willing to lead right into battle. And for good leadership in your family, in your home, men, you have to be out in front. You have to be the ones that are willing to patch things up, be willing to take that courageous step. And Jacob does that here because, you know, it takes courage to face somebody that's offended and try to patch things up, doesn't it? Most of us want to ignore it. We don't want to be courageous. We want to be wimps. We don't want to face them anymore. We might not mind talking bad behind their back, but to talk to their face, that's a whole different thing. And so Jacob gets in front, but not only is he courageous, but he's humble. As Esau is closing the distance between these two groups, he gets down with his dislocated hip that's just been put back into socket, and he hobbles down to the ground, and then he bows. And then he gets back up and takes a few steps, and he gets down on the ground and bows. He does this 7 times until Esau gets there, not knowing if Esau is going to kill him or hug him. His fear, seeing 400 men come towards him, is that he's going to do him harm. That seems to be the obvious picture. Yet, broken before the Lord, courageous to seek to patch things up, and now humble, qualities that are important if you're going to patch things up, he's surprised by reconciliation. Man, it's a great thing to be surprised by reconciliation. Esau jumps off his horse, comes running at his brother. He's going to smack me in the face. He's going to pull out a knife. He's going to, because his last meeting with Esau, Esau had threatened to kill him and let everybody know, as soon as dad dies, I'm killing Jacob. And so he comes running at him. And don't you know that was a tense moment for Jacob as he doesn't know what to expect. But he runs, he embraces, he falls upon his neck, he kisses him, and the two of them cry like babies. This is a typical picture of Eastern passion. This is the way the people are over there, the Israelis and the people in the Middle East. They're very passionate people and cry and yell and scream. And this is not quite what the picture would be with our Western demeanor. It'd be more like a handshake and let's have a burger together. But for them, this passion, and you can note it or underline in verse 4, there are five verbs that Jacob's brokenness, Jacob's prayer, Jacob's humbleness before his brother, that Esau ran, he embraced, he fell on his neck, he kissed him, and he wept. Five verbs that Esau appears, even if he intended harm, when he sees his brother, his heart of stone melts. This is his twin brother. He hasn't seen him for 20 years. And it's almost as if all of the past, all of the water under the bridge, all of the offenses, all of the garbage, all of the being deceived out of the birthright and the blessing that Jacob done to him. In this moment, this emotional moment, as these two men come together, these two brothers, and they see each other's face for the first time in 20 years, it's as if in this emotional moment, it's all just swept away, just evaporates. Poof. And as Esau is kissing Jacob and they're hugging and they're crying together, don't you know Jacob's surprise? Wow, I thought this was going to be a bad thing. And look at this. Now, the interesting thing to me is that in this emotional openness that these two men have, which is an awkward thing for men, this kind of emotional openness. And I think when reconciliation happens, there needs to be that emotional openness because, you know, you can tell when you're talking to somebody if they have a guard up. You can feel that distance or that strain that's there. But when there's an emotional openness, and this is also a key to reconciliation, because if I feel that you're holding back, then I'm going to hold back. And, you know, you kind of cue off each other how you're responding. If I feel like you're hedging and you're just wanting to get past this conflict, but there's no real reconciliation, then I also will be reserved and hold back. But in this emotional openness, everything evaporates. It's swept away. And the thing that kind of surprises me here, there's no rehashing of the past. I love that. I'm not much of a rehasher of the past. I just like to let go and move on, let go, move on, let go and move on. Actually, I can't survive in ministry unless I am wired that way. I have to be able to let go of wrongs and things said and all kinds of offenses and things that I hear people are saying about me and various things. If I hang on to every little thing and I'm thin-skinned and I, you know, that's the tough thing about ministry is that you have to learn to be thick-skinned and tender-hearted. But a lot of ministers get thin-skinned and hard-hearted. And any of us can get in that place. But, you know, when there's this openness that we see between these two men, there's no justifying of the past. Jacob doesn't launch into hey, you know, I just wanted to really tell you I'm sorry about that birthright thing and that blessing thing and, you know, how I've totally ripped you off my whole life, basically. And let's just hash that out. There's none of that. There's none of that. It's almost in the emotional openness that it so evaporates that they both look at each other and realize there's no need to go there. But so many people, in an attempt what they think of reconciliation, they come in rationalizing and justifying their behavior so much so that their attempt at reconciliation shoots themselves in the foot. Have you ever had this experience, husbands and wives? You feel badly about your behavior, but you feel justified in your behavior? And so you say, you decide, I'm going to go tell my wife, I'm sorry. I'm going to go tell my husband, I am sorry. I apologize. But it goes something like this. You know, honey, I want to tell you I'm sorry. But if you hadn't, and you, right, you're done. Your history, it's over. It's just because your attempt, yes, my behavior was wrong, but you also behave badly. And you want to somehow, point the finger at them. But you see, when there's real desire for reconciliation, you let that go. The self-justifying, the rationalization about my behavior, it dies. I'm going to own up to my part of the deal. And that's all I can do. I'm not going to try to convince you that you also have to, after I apologize, say, do you have something to tell me too? No. Now, once again, this is theoretical because I know you husbands and wives never have any conflicts. So, just in case any ever pop up in the future, if you really want to be in reconciliation, the word reconcile means to make friendly relationships where there has been hostility. Now it's friendly rather than hostile. Jacob, Esau, they come together, and it's kind of a full reconciliation because now there's family introductions. Esau says, who are these? And now Jacob introduces the Bilhah and Zilpah and their children, and Leah and her children, and Rachel and Joseph, and they go through the formal introductions. Well, it's not quite enough in the sense that there is reconciliation, but Jacob still has a desire for his brother to receive the gift. In a sense, restitution. Though he doesn't describe it that way, he just wants to be giving this gift. It says in verse 8, then Esau said, what do you mean by all this company which I met? And he said, these are to find favor in the sight of my Lord. But Esau said, I have enough. My brother, keep what you have for yourself. And Jacob said, no, please, if I have found favor in your sight, then receive my present from my hand, inasmuch as I have seen your face as though I had seen the face of God. And you were pleased with me. Please take my blessing that is brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough. So he urged him, and he took it. One of the things that you see happening through this restoration process is it appears that Jacob, who three times in not only the reconciliation part, but also in this restitution part, three times he mentions the Lord. And God has graciously given me these wives and children. And God has graciously blessed me in my business, the prosperity of my flock. And you hear none of that in Esau, where there's a real contrast. And you sense through this that after 20 years and Jacob walking with the Lord, he actually is trying to be a witness to his heathen brother. You see, the scriptures are very clear. There's only a few people in the Bible that the Bible is so really declares that they're lost, they're unsaved, they're not right with God, and they're never going to be right with God. And that is, Esau is one of those guys. Now, the troubling thing about this, as you watch the examination between Jacob's life and Esau's life, that at times I actually think that Esau is a little more forthright than Jacob is. And that's troubling. But I have the same experience in life. I know some people that are not Christians. Do you know anybody like this? That are more honest, they're straight shooters, they're honest in their business deals, they have a strong family, they have a sense of morality, basically they have a sense of godliness without a relationship with God. Do you know anybody like that? And then you compare them by degree and to Christians that you know that are total flakes. And they're saved and they're kind of wishy-washy and they're not real good with the truth yet. They're not real good in their morality, and they might be drunk one week and in sexual immorality the other week and over here and there. And they've received Christ and they're saved. But here's this unsaved person. He actually looks better in character than this born again person. That troubles me. It troubles me in that I have to get to the place that I understand that there are many people who believe their own morality and their own righteousness apart from Christ is good enough to get them to heaven. And they look squeaky clean. They'd do anything for you. And personally, they seem to have a very polished character. But you see, Jesus said the only way to get to the Father is through faith in him. And so a lot of faltering, struggling, wishy-washy people come the way of the cross, and they're going to enter into the kingdom of heaven before those who have their act together but see no need for Christ. And it appears that Jacob's trying to be a witness to his brother. He says, Esau does, what do you mean by this company that I passed? And we looked at it last week. He gave some 580 animals, sheep and goats and camels and donkeys and all of this stuff. He gave all of that as a gift. And he said, oh, these are to find favor in the sight of my Lord. God has graciously given them to me. Notice Jacob's testimony. God has blessed me with these. I give them to you as a gift. But what's Esau's response? I have enough. There's no, oh, God has given me enough. Esau is a godless man. He doesn't see God in any aspect of life. He's one of those guys. He's a man's man. I pull myself up by my own bootstraps or my own sandal straps, I guess, in their culture. And he just, you know, I don't need God. Why are you always giving God the glory? You and Dad, Isaac, he might think of his father. And Grandpa Abraham, you guys are all just Jesus freaks. What's your problem? I have the wealth that I have earned with these two hands, Esau's perspective is. Jacob's perspective is, God has blessed me. God has been good to me. He gives glory to God. And he wants to be that witness to his brother. And he says, you know, you have to understand there's a couple of subtle cultural things here, according to historians, that is important. And that is that you would not receive a gift from an enemy, only from a friend. And by urging him, he would urge him. And this is a second thing apart from the first. And that is, in the East, if you offer a gift to somebody, it's only polite in their culture to refuse the gift. Oh, I can't take that. But then they insist and you go, okay, I'll take that. And so he refuses and then Jacob insists. And also when he receives it, he's basically telling Jacob this. We're now on friendly terms because I won't receive a gift from an enemy, but I'll receive it from you. You're my brother. I receive it. And so as he receives it, basically, though it's not here, you can tell from Jacob's point of view, you know, I'd really like to make the past right, though we're not going to rehash it. I'd just like to be generous with this gift. Jacob has felt bad for 20 years for how he's tried to rip off his brother. God had promised him the birthright. God had promised him the blessing. He didn't have to go at it in the deceptive way that him and his mother, Rebecca, tried to get it. He wanted to make it right. You know, sometimes because God has forgiven us, we feel like other people that we've wronged, that it's good with them as well. You know, when I was a young man, when I was 15, I was hanging out on a Friday night, Saturday night, something like that, with some friends. And I jumped in the pickup of a classmate of mine, a girl. She had a brand new D50 pickup, and her and her boyfriend were in a fight and an argument. And I said, well, while you guys are trying to figure this out, this other friend of mine, can we go drive around? And so we were driving down the cruise, and I'm 15, and it's nighttime. I'm not supposed to be driving because I'm not 16. And we had been drinking. And we were talking to girls out the passenger window, and I had my head turned on the cruise in the big metropolis of Twin Falls, Idaho. And we were talking to these girls, and a guy stopped because of traffic right in front of me, and he had one of those homemade Idaho bumpers. I mean, it's angle iron. I mean, the thing's just this massive bumper. And I didn't see him stop, and I was going probably about 30 miles an hour, and I smashed into the back of this truck with this little brand-new D50 Dodge pickup mini truck. And I smashed the whole front end of this brand new vehicle in. And now I realize, and when I did it, my chin had hit the steering wheel, so I had this big goose egg that was sticking off my chin. And the guy waves me over, come on, let's go over here and, you know, want to exchange insurance and call the cops, wait for, well, I'm underage to drive at night. I am definitely over the legal limit of drinking alcohol. And I'm in trouble, and it's not even my truck. And so I did the next best thing that good heathens do, and that is I fled the scene. And so I hit and ran, and I'm driving down the cruise with the whole front end of this rig just smashed and the lights and everything. And I didn't know what to do, so I just drove it back to the bar where I had left my other friend. This is her vehicle. And I just left the keys in the truck and went home like nothing ever happened. You guys should be very thankful I'm saved because I am such a jerk without Jesus. And so I just left the truck there. And then about 2 a.m, my classmate and her boyfriend, I hear him pounding on the door, and it's 2 a.m. I'm like, oh no, they've hunted me down. And So I go out there to kind of face the music. Well, one thing turned to another. Her father had told her not to let anybody drive the truck. So because he was upset at her, he made her pay for the repairs of the vehicle, not with her insurance, but with her college money. And so she told me this, and one thing led to another. And basically, I didn't pay her back. And years went by, and now she's in college. She calls me from college. And I'm 18. We're both out of, it's her freshman year. And she says, you know, Rick, I really want you to think about paying me back because I'm in college now and I'm going to need that money. And I said, you're out of your mind. And I hung up on her. You guys won't come back next weekend after the story, but. But then that next February, actually this month is February. So 24 years ago. So 24 years ago, I get saved. And one of the things that as the Lord has forgiven me for so much, one of the things, her name and that whole story would come up in my mind. And I would kind of justify it. I said, Lord, you've forgiven me for all of that. That's why Jesus died on the cross, right? And it was like the Spirit of the Lord when he speaks to your heart, like, yeah, but she hasn't. I hate it when he does that. It's like, you know, I'm right with you, but, you know, I'm not right with her. And so the years went by, and I ended up getting married, but I didn't have the money at that time. It was about $1,500 at the time, but I had made a couple of payments. So it was like $1,000, $1,100, something like that. I got married. We bought our first house, and I fixed up that house, and I sold it for a profit. And how times have changed. Our first house was $28,000. And I told my wife, now I'm 23. It's been 7 or 8 years since I wrecked this vehicle. I wasn't a Christian. And I said, the first thing that I want to do when we sell this house is I want to call Nikki up. And I want to give her that $1,000 or whatever I owe her. I'll just call her up. My wife understood because, you know, she's born again now. And she's like, that'd be awesome, honey. So we sell the house and I call Nikki up. Hi, Nikki. Hi, Rick. Said, how much did I, you know, still owe you? And I think it was $1,000 or $1,100. And so she told me, and I said, Tammy's going to bring a check down. And she laughed out loud. It's been 7 or 8 years. And I just told her on the phone, I said, you know, Nikki, I'm a Christian now. And the Lord has forgiven me, and he's changed my life. And I just want to ask your forgiveness for being such a jerk. And it wasn't right, and I want to make it right, and I hope you can find it in your heart to forgive me. And here's this money to make it right. And so Tammy took the check down to Nikki, and the first thing that Nikki asked was, what church are you guys going to anyway? It was one of those, she's like, if anything can change Rick like that, I want to go check it out. And I think the reality that sometimes, you know, for Jacob, 20 years had went by, but he just said, Esau, I want to give you this gift. I know 20 years has went by. I know you say you don't need it. You have enough. I know you're not walking with God. You don't care anything about that. But, you know, I just want to make this right with you. And there's a place in our life not only to experience reconciliation with the Lord and reconciliation with people, there's also a place for restitution. And that is making things right with people that we have hurt, if it is within our means to do so. Sometimes things are beyond our means. We can't do it. But here, Jacob goes that extra mile and gives the gift. But if you have restoration and fellowship, if you have restitution, everything's right, why would there be the need for separation as we see in verse 12? It says, then Esau said, let us take our journey, let us go, and I will go before you. But Jacob said to him, my Lord knows that the children are weak and the flocks and herds which are nursing are with me. And if the men should drive them hard one day, all the flock will die. Please let my Lord go on ahead before his servant. I will lead on slowly at a pace which the livestock that go before me and the children are able to endure until I come to my Lord in Seir. And Esau said, now let me leave with you some of the people who are with me. But he said, what need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of my Lord. So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir. Esau is generous. He wants to escort him all the way to Mount Seir. Now, this seems maybe in their Eastern culture of hospitality that he wants to escort him all the way down south, Mount Seir, or the land of Edom, the Edomites, the most prominent city, and you can go see it even to this day, the city of the rock city of Petra or Petra, which I was there actually 10 years ago, in this prominent capital of Esau's nation. And he wants Jacob to go, but Jacob here is typical Jacob. He begins to hedge and say, oh, I'll follow and I'll come later. He has no intention of going to be with his brother. He doesn't. He's going to go and veer north, actually, and camp out there, as we'll see next week. He doesn't follow his brother, and he just kind of hedges and says, oh, you know, the flocks are just so tender, they'll die if we drive them hard one day. And he goes, well, I'll leave a few men to protect you. Now, what need is there? I'll come along. And some commentators give credit, maybe in the smallest way, that Jacob, though it's not recorded in Scripture, might have made his journey down there to visit his brother. But we don't know. Why does Jacob feel the need to separate from Esau? Well, it's the same need that you and I sense that when we are walking with God and somebody in close relationship to us, sometimes it is a brother, a sister, a mom or a dad, a coworker, a lifetime friend that we've grown up with. When they're not walking with God, there is a need for separation. Though I might be reconciled to them, things are patched up, there's no animosity. But it's just that I can't hang out with them every weekend. You know what I mean? There are certain people that have an influence on our lives, and there has to be a separation in the Christian life. And I have relationships from years ago that as the years have went and I have chosen to follow Jesus and these relationships have chosen not to follow the Lord, though you're still friendly when you see, you're still, hey, how you doing? You extend that loving heart that I believe God wants for all of his people to show to a lost world. There has been so much distance. There's so much water under the bridge in the way that our lives have went separate ways. Look back over your life of it. Well, if you don't have much history, it's hard to do, but how long you've walked with the Lord and how that separation has come. Isn't it sometimes something that tangles us up that we try to maintain the closeness of friendship with the unsaved people that we have spent so much time with? When we try to maintain it, what happens is our influence, especially in the early years, is not very strong. So I fall into the old ruts of all of my old friends as I try to, because, you know, when you've been friends for years, it's a hard thing. I love you. I love to hang out with you. We've been friends for years. But when I hang out with you, this is what you want to do. And I don't want to do that anymore. I want to follow the Lord. I want to please him. And there's got to be some separation. That's why the Bible tells us not to be unequally yoked together with unbelievers in 2 Corinthians chapter 6. Don't be yoked. Don't be yoked in marriage. Don't be entangled in a business partnership. Don't be yoked in a way that now you're locked together in some contract, in some agreement, in some covenant, because you're going to have real struggles. As it says in the Old Testament law, that a ox and a donkey were not to be yoked together to plow. Can you picture it out in the field? An ox and a donkey together in a yoke, it doesn't quite work. They have different temperaments, different heights, different ways in which you yoke them and all this stuff. It doesn't make any sense. And yet I know so many people that the biggest stumbling block in their life is their desire to maintain ungodly relationships in an intimate way. It's almost as when they stumble and fall, they can always say, I was with them again. I was with him. I was with her. Now, if you are in a marriage relationship where you are unequally yoked, they're an unbeliever, the man or the woman, and you're walking with the Lord, then once you're in the relationship, then the Lord says, make the best of it. If an unbeliever is willing to live with you in your Christianity, then so be it. Praise the Lord. Make the best of it. Hang in there. But you're going to have struggles. It's struggles that I don't know that, as I've tried to communicate it with people that are in love with each other and they're getting ready to get married. And I say, say, are you both born again? Well, she is. She's grown up, you know, at the church and she's known Jesus since she was little. But I'm not. So, well, you know, I got to share with you guys. Shouldn't get married. Oh, we get along so well. Well, I know maybe now. Now. But then the kids grow up and you're going to have a baby dedication, and his religion of a different sort would dictate that something else happen, and you get into all of these conflicts, and they look at you with these stars in the eyes like, no, we will never have any conflicts. Right. Now with two Christians, life can be a challenge with our own selfishness and our, you know, sinful nature, let alone two people that are going opposite different directions eternally. And spiritually. Though there are people, don't get me wrong, there are people that I know that are unequally yoked in marriage, and they have learned how to tolerate it. And that's what it is. It's toleration. The man tolerates the woman coming to church here this morning, or vice versa. The woman's at home and the man's here. Jacob senses the need. I need to go deeper into the promised land. Esau actually is leaving the promised land to the land that's going to be called the land of the Edomites. He's going to establish that outside of the promised land. Jacob senses the need to go deeper in the things of God. Esau wants nothing to do with the things of God. Therefore, there's only a natural progression that takes place, and that is greater distance between the two. And you have to, whether it's embrace it or get used to it, that's going to happen in relationships that you have. Maybe relationships that you've had for many years, though there's still a friendliness, there's still a love, there's still a congeniality, but you're not yoked. What relationships in your life lead you deeper into the things of God? Nurture those relationships. What relationships are there in your life that are leading you away from the things of God? Begin to let those go. Because iron sharpens iron, so does a friend sharpen the countenance of a friend. And just as spiritual, godly fellowship sharpens my walk with God, a cold, ungodly heart dulls my senses if I'm with them too long. If I want to hang out with them every Saturday or whatever it is, it begins to dull my senses because I hear their constant ungodliness and I begin to drift back towards it because, you see, I have this sinful nature. It's natural to me. It's natural to me to cuss like they cuss. It's natural to me to act like they act. It's natural to me, you know, that's who I was. But it's now supernatural to walk with God. It's different. And so though Jacob reconciles with Esau, gives restitution to Esau, he says, we must go our separate ways. I want to go deeper in the things of God. He wants to leave the things of God. I let him go. And so must we. Because there's lots of relationships that we're going to see go down that path.